Hi, I'm April Fulton.
And I'm Rebecca Davis, and this is Your Health, the weekly podcast from NPR Science Desk.
On today's show, healthcare across the country.
In Tennessee, the state Medicaid program shortchanges prevention.
While in Pennsylvania, low-income adults face losing their state-funded health insurance.
And just what do Americans really know about the federal healthcare law? We'll find out when we chat with our health blogger Scott Hensley, who also has some news from the world of cystic fibrosis.
And one skeptical woman's quest for perfection through yoga.
But first, keeping your body and your mind strong as you age. Patty Namond has this story on weightlifting as the best prescription to battle dwindling muscles as we get older.
Muscle loss really picks up after the age of 60. People can lose about 2 pounds of muscle every 5 years, which begs the question, can we turn that around?
Absolutely. You absolutely can build muscle as you age.
Dr. David Heber directs UCLA's Center for Human Nutrition.
You have to do what we call resistance exercise, and this can take a lot of different forms. It could be lifting weights. It could be stretchy bands. But the key is you have to stretch a muscle.
This is not yoga. It's not flexibility. It's about lifting weight, stretching a muscle to the point of straining it and then adding more weight. That's how you set in motion the body's natural muscle building response.
The muscle now has to adapt because your body feels, hey, you just did this weightlifting today. This must be your new job now to lift this weight. So your body is now going to adapt those particular muscle fibers that you stretched to be able to take in more weight the next day.
Could you hook up this straight bar for me? Thanks.
Sandy Pally is 73 years old. She works out 5 days a week, 2 hours each day. Today she's lifting weights at the gym at Arizona State University in Tempe.
I use leg extension, I use leg curls, I'll do back extensions, tricep extensions.
Pally started lifting weights about 10 years ago, shortly after she was diagnosed with osteoporosis. She was losing bone mass, which she didn't realize. She was losing muscle mass as well. And weight training builds both. So Pally went to the gym 3 days a week. It didn't cost much, and student trainers were there to help. Within a year, she was able to compete in the local Senior Olympics.
My top score was 380 pounds. I squatted 135, I benched 80, and I deadlifted 165.
Pally has a drawer full of silver and gold medals.
Sandy is like a hero to me. I think she's an outstanding role model.
Mark Peterson first met Sandy Pally when he was a student. Now Peterson's a researcher at the University of Michigan, and he's just completed a study looking at this very question, can older people reverse the process of muscle loss?
What we found was, boy, people beyond the age of 50 make dramatic increases, much more dramatic increases than I think was historically thought.
After 5 months of lifting weights 2 to 3 times a week, both men and women increased their muscle mass on average by nearly 2.5 pounds. Not only did that reverse age-related muscle loss, it actually built lots of new muscle.
If you were to ask me how much strength is enough, I would say I can't answer that question. I think more strength is always better within reason.
Muscle strength and balance prevent falls, which is one of the most common reasons seniors end up in hospitals. But if you're like most people over 50, you don't get much exercise. So Peterson says start slowly with weightlifting. For example, just get in and out of a chair.
The ability to stand up out of a chair is actually is very compromised beyond the age of 65. So actually using one's body mass as a load itself would be a very reasonable way to start.
So stand up and sit down. Do it at least 10 times. Don't push up with your hands. And when that's easy, add a little weight like small barbells. When you get to the point where you're really weight training, Dr. Heber says don't forget to eat a little something after each workout.
If you don't do that, your muscles are going to be broken down because during your exercise, you've developed what we call an oxygen debt, where you have to pay back your body for the energy you've burned. And in the absence of having protein and some carbohydrate, your body is going to take the muscle and break it down to do that.
Sandy Pally thinks it's all really worth it.
I feel strong. I can lift the bags of groceries and things like that without too much sweat.
Patty Namond, NPR News.
Macho man, yeah. I've got to be a macho man, yeah. I've got to be a macho man.
Exercise may have another bonus for people over 60. Michelle Trudeau reports on new research that suggests exercise can also improve memory.
The hippocampus in your brain is small, smaller than your pinky, but it plays a big role in memory. Now, as part of normal aging, the hippocampus shrinks, and this shrinkage accelerates as you grow older, foreshadowing memory problems. But scientists now know that the hippocampus can also grow, get bigger, not just in young people, but throughout our lifespan.
And there has been a huge amount of work over the past decade, mostly in animals, but also in humans,
says neuroscientist Peter Snyder from Brown University,
showing that new cells are created and new connections are made between cells in this particular area of the brain in response to experience.
Snyder's interested in what we can do to maintain memory, even as our brains age. He looks at diet, exercise, nutritional supplements, brain games.
Of all of these non-invasive ways of intervening, it is exercise that seems to have the most efficacy at this point, more so than nutritional supplements, vitamins, and cognitive interventions.
Some of the most provocative evidence on the power of exercise comes from a study just published by neuroscientist Art Kramer at the University of Illinois, documenting the impact of exercise on the growth of the hippocampus in a small group of elderly people over the course of 1 year. Here's Art Kramer.
The participants in our study were 120 very sedentary people. They're relatively healthy, but certainly couch potatoes would fit as a label.
A semi-couch potato, let's put it that way.
Greg Stanton took part in the study. He's a 66-year-old semi-retired university professor. Stanton admits to not exercising regularly and knowing he should. And that's why he, along with 120 other men and women, 60 to 80 years old, qualified for Art Kramer's two exercise groups.
One was the aerobic exercise group. Those were people who walked further and faster as time went on. And the others in our control group were in a toning, stretching, and light strengthening group.
I went into the aerobic exercise group, and basically it's walking a track in one of the gym facilities.
For about 40 minutes, three times a week, for a year.
And the idea was to try to get in as many laps as possible, and turned out for me about 3 miles a session.
Now, all the people in the study had brain MRIs done before the study and again a year later when the study ended. Researcher Art Kramer.
And what we found is that the individuals in the aerobic group showed increases in the volume of their hippocampus.
2% bigger after a year of aerobic exercise. For those in the control group who did toning, stretching, light weightlifting for the year, well, their hippocampus shrunk about 1.5%, suggesting that not only did the aerobic exercise protect against normal shrinkage, but also that new cells were added to the hippocampus. Again, neuroscientist Peter Snyder.
To see a volume change in a structure of about 2% means that there really is very significant change going on in that region of the brain.
The growth of the hippocampus in the aerobic group was also associated with improvements in spatial memory, an important kind of memory that records information about your environment, like the layout of your neighborhood or the interior of the grocery store. For this study, Kramer looked only at spatial memory, but in previous studies, verbal and other types of memory improved after an aerobic exercise program. As for Greg Stanton, the 66-year-old semi-couch potato, he says he didn't notice any improvement in his memory.
I always had a difficulty remembering names, and it's getting worse, actually.
But he did notice he had more physical stamina after the year of aerobic exercise. In spite of this, he still doesn't maintain a regular exercise regimen. The reason?
I have less time than I think I should have.
Like many of us, he knows exercise is good for him, but he's just too busy to do it. For NPR News, I'm Michelle Trudeau.
Try to remember the kind of September when life was slow and oh so mellow.
And now, let's check in with our healthy, hardworking, non-muscle dwindling blogger, Scott Hensley. He's putting his BlackBerry away, so he's with us now. Hi, Scott.
Here I am.
Hello.
I'll try to live up to all those adjectives. Hi, April.
We're trying to add more every week, apparently.
So far, so good. I like them.
Okay. So, Scott, you had a conversation this week with the head of the Cystic Fibrosis Foundation about this experimental new medicine that may be helping some people with the disease.
I did, and I have to say, this is a one of those rare times where a drug gets information about a new drug gets released in a press release, and I feel that it should get more attention than it got. And the reason is that after decades of trying to find a medicine that gets at the cause of cystic fibrosis, it looks like they're really on to something. I mean, it might be nice to have a refresher on cystic fibrosis. I mean, maybe not all of our listeners are familiar with it. Yeah, so while a rare disease, it is one of the most common genetically determined diseases, especially in Caucasians. And the problem is that a defective gene, which was found more than 20 years ago as the root cause of this, leads to problems in the body that interfere with breathing is the biggest problem. So you have a kind of a mucus buildup because the cells that line the lungs aren't working right.
Okay. So what does the new drug that you're talking about do?
This drug modifies a protein on the cells in people who have a very particular form of cystic fibrosis. So let's be clear. One caveat here is that this drug was tested for people who have a particular mutation that's about 4% of cystic fibrosis patients. So all told, maybe 4,000 or 5,000 people in the world have this particular variation and could benefit from this drug. But the effects were profound.
Really?
And I called Robert Bell, head of the Cystic Fibrosis Foundation, to find out what he had to say about the findings.
We always felt that if we could treat the basic defect in cystic fibrosis, we would be able to have a much more profound impact on the disease. And the data this morning really show that is the way to go.
So it really improved their breathing. It didn't just keep it from getting worse. Their breathing got better, and the effect was sustained at almost up to a year. Hmm. Now, I don't want to sound like a commercial for this drug. It hasn't been reviewed and published in a peer-reviewed journal, and there are lots of caveats. But I think that after all the years of trying to find something after the gene was discovered, which mm-hmm. many people thought, oh, it'll be just around the corner. Now, really, they're getting close to something. And I think this is a drug that really bears watching. I have one last thing to say about it.
Okay.
And that is, if this drug does make it to market, it is going to cost a ton.
Of course.
Try $250,000 a year.
Wow.
And it's a twice-a-day pill.
Oh.
So that's bound to cause some controversy when it comes out. But for a drug that treats a small population and has such a profound effect, there are other medicines that are in that ballpark, and that's why analysts think that it might happen that way.
Why so expensive? Was it an incredibly expensive drug to research and develop?
The Cystic Fibrosis Foundation, which is a co-sponsor of the research and has really pushed for this drug, has put $75 million into it alone. And this is really the in this class of what are called orphan drugs that make a huge difference for a small number of people. And so we've seen other drugs that are priced in this range. And it's a combination of how much it costs to develop them, which is substantial, plus a value on what a profound effect they can have on patients.
And Scott, is there anything about this particular drug that might be in what they've learned in developing it that might be applied to the larger group of people who have CF?
I think they're going to do more tests to see how it will help people with different genetic variants. There's a spectrum of mm-hmm. problems that can happen with this gene, so they are going to do more testing. This made sense to be kind of the target group, and it certainly validates the notion that if you can identify where this particular genetic defect is and figure out which protein is messed up, you can come up with a treatment. And they've now, after years and years, appear to be well on the way to doing that.
Okay. Well, all right. So also speaking of not being able to breathe very well, there was a post on cigarettes on the blog, electronic cigarettes. What was that about?
Yeah, we've written a fair amount in the last few months about these electronic cigarettes. They're quite controversial. You know, the FDA, as April has written, has these new powers to regulate tobacco and cigarettes. And there's some controversy of, well, does that extend to these electronic cigarettes, which for people who aren't familiar with them are a way of delivering nicotine in a kind of water vapor so that it kind of looks like a cigarette. It's a little plastic thing, and you're able to puff on it, but instead of smoke, you get nicotine in water vapor down into your lungs. And so people who are dependent on nicotine say, hey, look, this is an option that doesn't bother anybody else. Companies say it's safer. FDA isn't so sure. Mm.
There's no secondhand smoke, presumably.
No, exactly, no secondhand smoke. So there's a lot of action in the courts right now about should the FDA have the power to regulate these things or not. We wondered, Eliza Barkley, who writes often for the blog, wondered, well, how's this going in the air? She was wondering, are there any airlines that still allow regular cigarette smoking? And she found out that the answer was no. Mm-hmm. But she also, while she was digging around, learned that some airlines are allowing these e-cigarettes. The U.S. Department of Transportation said that's a no-go, so here you can't do it. But overseas in Europe, some airlines are even selling the e-cigarettes on board, as I understand it. So it really kind of puts a point on this issue of, well, how safe are these? And for people who are dependent on nicotine, I suppose they could try the gum, but some of them could make an argument, look, I'm not bothering anybody by just sucking this water vapor down. Get off my back. So that's what we wrote about, and a lot of people weighed in the comment stream about whether it was a good idea.
Well, we and other people have been reporting an awful lot about the new healthcare law and what it means to people, what Congress is doing, what the president's doing, blah, blah, blah. But Scott, you wrote about a rather eye-opening survey on healthcare in the blog this week. What the heck was that about?
Oh, I feel we're not doing a good enough job getting the reporting out there because a survey by the Kaiser Family Foundation, a nonpartisan group that's focused on health issues, health policy issues, found that more than one in five Americans believe right now that the big federal health law has already been repealed.
One in five people in the United States, according to this survey, believe that the federal health care law has been repealed.
It's gone.
We don't have it. So all the scrapping and the fighting over it and the threats by the Republicans, they think it's already gone.
It's done. Yeah, they think it's done. And that was actually 22%. Then another 26% aren't sure. Don't know, aren't sure. So you have basically half the country either thinks it's been repealed or doesn't know, and the other half knows, maybe they read shots, that yes, it is still the law. Hasn't been fully implemented. It's really just getting rolling in that regard. So you could imagine that people saw the big, largely symbolic vote by the House in early January when the Republicans came in, took control, and said, we told voters we are going to force an up or down vote on overhaul. They did. And the Republicans voted to repeal it
in the House.
But as we've documented, and as I think a lot of other people have reported, the Senate, still controlled by Democrats, has pretty much made
just
clear,
barely.
Right, just barely, but enough to say, look, that's not going to happen over here.
Mm-hmm.
And just to make clear, and we did do this on Shots, because we reproduced President Obama's memo saying, if this House bill somehow made it through the Senate and came to my desk, I promise I will veto it.
Mm-hmm.
So it's just a startling finding that there is such a large percentage of people who think, well, this is already done. And I think it's troubling because this is these are really important issues, and it's reasonable for people to keep debating them and try and figure out, well, how are we going to do it? But it would sure be better if folks were kind of up to speed on what's happening. So we're going to keep writing about it.
It may be that the people who didn't realize this aren't really stakeholders in the debate. They're people who were either younger, on the, you know, because you're in your 20s and you don't really think about health insurance and health care all that much. It's just not relevant to you because you're going to live forever. And or they could be folks
Invincibles.
Who just are, you know, incredibly busy and, you know, aren't really keeping up.
Or the media is doing a bad job explaining it, or President Obama is doing a bad job explaining it.
Well,
there's probably
sometimes
a lot of
reasons. There's such a flood of constant patter about everything in this country at this point and all over the world. I'm sure it's the same that, you know, I can sort of see how people would get a little confused. I think it's disheartening because you do want people to know the facts and the status of something as important as the federal health care law.
Okay. Well, thanks a lot, Scott. Appreciate your help.
My pleasure. Look forward to next week's adjective.
Oh, yes. Have
we'll
a good one.
We'll have to work on that one.
Well, unless the government health plan is actually repealed, it will come into full effect by the year 2014. But that's a little too late for nearly 42,000 low-income people in Pennsylvania. They recently received letters telling them that come the end of the month, they'll join the ranks of the uninsured.
That's because their health plan, which is subsidized by the state, is out of money. And the new Republican governor, Tom Corbett, is shutting it down altogether. Jenny Gold of our partner Kaiser Health News reports on what it may mean.
Paula Michelle Boyle and her husband, Tom, are longtime residents of Philadelphia. He's a contractor, and she recently started a new career as a life coach. Both own their own businesses, and together they bring in about $25,000 a year.
We're above poverty level, but we really don't make enough to afford regular cost health insurance.
If they lived anywhere else, they'd probably be uninsured. But lucky for them, Pennsylvania is one of a handful of states in the country that has a special health insurance program for low-income adults who aren't eligible for Medicaid. Both Paula and her husband are cancer survivors.
It really, you know, was a lifesaver because I was able to go to doctors and have follow-up care.
She's been on the program, Adult Basic, for 8 years, and her husband for 5. It cost them each just $36 a month. But earlier this month, they got a letter in the mail explaining that their coverage is ending.
Well, I got the letter, and I kind of took it a little personal, thinking that maybe it was us. So I read it a little further and thought, sounds like it's the whole thing is being terminated.
She called the number on the letter to find out.
Thank you for calling the Adult Basic Helpline. Coverage under the Adult Basic program is ending on February 28, 2011, due to lack of funding.
We were like in shock over this. You know, what are we going to do now? We need doctor's visits and testings.
The money for the program came from a state tobacco settlement, plus a deal with Pennsylvania's 4 Blue Cross and Blue Shield plans. The deal was supposed to expire in December, and the insurers agreed to keep it going through June. But the program has simply run out of money, and the state is facing a $4 billion hole in its budget. Here's State Senator Ted Erickson, a Republican.
As the economy was growing, and as we were collecting more and more taxes, we expanded so many programs. We put new programs in place. Well, it's time now to go back and take a look at many of those programs to see whether we can truly afford them.
Erickson says that instead of funding health insurance, the government should spend more money funding community health centers. Others argue the program should be saved and blame the Blue Cross and Blue Shield companies for not contributing more of their revenues. Jay Costa is the Democratic leader of the Pennsylvania State Senate.
I think it was done in haste. I think that enough consideration wasn't given to try to find a resolution to maintaining the program.
He says about $50 million is needed to extend the program until June 30th. And then what to do until 2014? That's when many of the people enrolled in Adult Basic will get subsidized coverage or Medicaid as a result of the new federal health law. Alan Weil is executive director of the National Academy for State Health Policy. He says Pennsylvania is facing what most states are facing, tough choices created by budget deficits.
I hate to say it's to be expected, but I think it's not shocking. There just are so few places that states have room in their budgets, and this is a program that, because it doesn't operate under federal rules, they can grow or shrink as their fiscal conditions permit.
Pennsylvania reached an agreement with the Blues to let recipients shift into another plan for low-income people, but it costs up to nearly $200 a month and covers only 4 doctor visits a year, not nearly enough for people like the Boyles. Paula Michelle tried to get a private health plan with better benefits, but was told that her cancer diagnosis makes her uninsurable. Coverage for her husband would cost $1,000 each month.
We're kind of scrounging, thinking we may have to give up our home just so that we could pay a high premium.
She says after 19 years in the same house, that would be a difficult decision. For NPR News, I'm Jenny Gold.
Tennessee's state Medicaid program faces hundreds of millions of dollars in budget cuts in the coming months. You may remember that program. It's known as TennCare, and its critics say it too often pays for expensive treatments while overlooking prevention. For example, it won't pay for overweight patients to get consulting from dietitians, but it will pay for the morbidly obese to lose weight through surgery like a gastric bypass. And that has led some critics to complain. TennCare won't pay for an ounce of prevention, but it will pay for a pound of cure. From member station WPLN in Nashville, Daniel Potter reports.
2 years ago, Jane Leck weighed more than 250 pounds. She's in her mid-40s, and TennCare was paying for her heart and blood pressure medicine, and she was pre-diabetic.
I've always battled obesity. It's genetically. I have family members that are all obese.
Lex says she's only ever been close to a normal size when taking diet pills, but she quit because of side effects, gaining back her old weight and then some. Eventually, TennCare paid for her to have a gastric bypass. Surgeons gave her less of a stomach, so she feels full faster and eats less. She's since gotten rid of almost all her old clothes.
Where would the 3 or 4 X's be?
To show how much weight she's lost, she leafs through a swap rack for obese people at her former clinic, where patients drop off old clothes as they slim down.
My jacket, my size 3X, before surgery, I could barely zip it, and now me and another person can get in it and zip it, so I've lost a whole person.
Leck figures the gastric bypass saved TennCare money, because otherwise she would have needed heart surgery and other operations, and she's off all her old medicines. The average price of such operations to TennCare, including facility costs, about $20,000. Almost all state Medicaid programs cover bariatric surgery, but only about half pay for diet counseling, and dietitian Sarah Jane Bedwell says Tennessee isn't one of them.
It's like saying, we're going to fill your cavities, but we're not going to ever pay for you to get your teeth cleaned or teach you how to brush your teeth.
Bedwell helps people fine-tune eating habits and even goes grocery shopping with clients, but TennCare won't cover her services, for which she charges $75 an hour. Bedwell contends she's much cheaper than a surgeon. That's an argument TennCare hears a lot of. Here's Chief Medical Officer Wendy Long.
For any benefit that we don't offer through the TennCare program, there is someone that would argue that it would be cost-effective for us to offer a new benefit.
While Tennessee ranks among the nation's fattest states, TennCare's budget is stretched thin because of sagging tax revenues. Long says if paying for dietitians saved the state money, they'd do it. But
there's really no evidence to support the fact that providing those services would result in a decrease in medical costs, certainly not immediately, and even in the longer term.
Long says patients on TennCare do get dietary counseling, just from physicians, not dietitians. And anyway, she argues, TennCare's hands are tied by a legal requirement to cover bariatric operations. Dr. Ronald Clements, head of bariatric surgery at Vanderbilt, sees no problem with the state paying for a gastric bypass.
The biggest bang for the buck in treatment of obesity is bariatric surgery, hands down. Nothing else comes close. However, only a small percentage of the obese patients qualify for it.
Patients have to be particularly obese and possibly sick before they're even considered for bariatric operations. Clement says such obese people almost never keep weight off by any means other than surgery. As to whether diet counseling could keep other people from reaching that point, Clement says that's hard to know. For NPR News, I'm Daniel Potter in Nashville.
We
When writer Claire Dederer first stepped into a yoga studio, she was, to put it mildly, dubious about the whole experience.
The scene was the very picture of white female self-indulgence. There were no Indian people in this room, that was certain. A woman in her late 20s entered and rolled out her mat in front of us. Her thick blonde hair was cut in an expensive bob. Her outfit was black and tight. She looked as though she had been a step aerobics teacher until about 5 minutes ago. She looked like her name was Jennifer. "I am a Tosa," she said. And I thought, like hell you are, sister.
But Dederer stuck with it. She found an instructor with a down-to-earth name, Fran. But that was just the beginning. She tells the story of her attempt to become perfect at yoga and life in her new book, Poser, My Life in 23 Yoga Poses. Dederer spoke with NPR's Linda Wertheimer.
Now, yoga seems to have been the thing to do when you started it. You write a very funny description of the yummy mummies of North Seattle. I wonder if you could just give us a few of the things that that you and all the other young mothers were trying to do.
Well, there was a list of rules, which kind of surprised me how stringent they were. You had to eat organic food, breastfeed your baby, well, at least till it could talk, carry your child in a sling. Strollers were completely banned. Expensive wooden toys because plastic might off-gas. You had to keep your job, but it had to be part-time, and you had to worry about it. Those are a few of the rules.
And one of the cure-alls, I gather, for everything that ailed you, from, you know, back pain to occasional depression, was yoga.
That's right. Yoga was sort of a one-stop shop for everything that you needed. You could get your exercise. You could feel extremely virtuous. After all, it's exercise you do with your hands in prayer position. And you could also get a break from your house. I'd go into the studio and I would think, this is a room I will never have to clean.
But it obviously became more than that, because you hang a memoir of... Well, I don't know. This memoir goes all the way back to when you were 7 and all the way forward to the present. You hang a memoir on yoga, 23 poses.
It's true. As a literary structure, I was surprised to find that the poses were really elastic. They lent themselves to metaphor and to exploration in a way that I didn't quite expect. And yoga itself was a path for me to try to become more perfect, more virtuous, completely good.
Completely good.
Yes.
Reading the book, I get the impression that one of the reasons you needed to be completely good was that your mother was not completely good.
Right. My mom was a matron in Seattle until 1973 and happily married. And one day she went to a pig roast, a classic 70s trope, where she fell in love with a hippie 8 years her junior and ran off with him and took us with her. And our life after that was a much more chaotic and complicated, interesting, adventurous life. And adventure is great, but it's not necessarily what children want. And I started to notice that my brother and I were both very concerned with this good kind of parenting, with this sort of always only buy the organic milk. And I felt that there were dots to connect between the chaotic way that we had experienced those years of my parents breaking up and our own experience as parents, that we were saying, no, we will never create this kind of chaos in our life. We're going to follow all the rules and everything will be fine.
So, I mean, everybody spends some time trying to separate themselves from their mother. Did yoga help with that?
Well, at first, yoga reiterated a lot of the stuff that I was thinking and feeling at the time about trying to be good and trying to follow all these rules. So I sort of went to yoga expecting to be better and better and better and to improve until finally I was perfectly virtuous and I could, you know, do a transition from scorpion into chaturanga. But what I found instead was that I would sort of fall down and be a mess and sweat and pass gas and do all the crazy things our bodies do, and that it was fine. And so yoga really ended up teaching me about loosening up and getting away from some of this perfectionism.
I loved in the book, I mean, I think we ought to say that despite the obviously serious concerns that you had, that you wrote a very funny book about your life. You shopped around, among other things, for yoga teachers. And you learned a little bit about yourself from each of your yoga teachers, like the lady who told you that in your yoga practice, you just should stay within the four corners of your mat.
She said you need to husband your gaze, which I thought was a really funny phrase. Like you were, your gaze was sheep and you were the shepherd and you were keeping all the sheep very close to you. But it was good advice. Stop looking around at what everyone else is doing. Put your focus right where it is. It's probably the best piece of yoga advice I ever got. Just keep your attention within the confines of your own mat.
In the end, do you think that you found some kind of path that took you where you needed to be?
I think I found the opposite of a path. I think I stopped looking for a path. I think I started to be more content with what I had and stopped being so concerned with trying to make everything better all the time.
Do you still do yoga?
I do. Many times a week.
That is Claire Dieterer. Her new book is called Poser, My Life in 23 Yoga Poses.
Y-O-G-A, karo yoga, yoga.
And that's all for Your Health, NPR's weekly health podcast. We had production assistance from our intern, Adam Cole.
And our health blogger is Scott Hensley. You can see the newest blog posts or browse through our archives at npr.org/shots.
We'll be back again next week if you just can't get enough of our podcast.
Thanks for listening.